It's Not Safe on Land or Sea, next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Good to be back with you again today. Barry, you know, I was just thinking about your opening statement. I don't think it's safe in the air either.
Well, yes, but we've talked about in the air so much, including these unmanned drone planes that are going to be flying all over our airways here in the United States, that thought maybe we should focus on something a little different. And, of course, what do you know? Our friends in Congress are going to help us out with that.
What else is new?
What else is new? That's right. It seems like this time, Charles, and as you and I were talking off air prior to starting this, we now are worried about losing our liberties at sea. And our listeners may be familiar with this. I know the acronym that's used for it, a lot of people get confused with what was a popular television program called Lost. But we're not talking about a fantasy brought to you on television. We're talking about a nightmare brought to you by the United Nations. LOST stands for the Law of the Sea Treaty. And so this treaty, which, Chuck, I think you and I were looking at, has been around since the early 1980s, in 1982, when the first UN Convention on the Laws of the Seas was put into place and the U.S. was asked to ratify it as part of the United Nations. Ever since 1982, so now we're looking at, what, 30 years now, ladies and gentlemen, 30 years every year, the Law of the Sea Treaty keeps coming back and coming back and coming back to the United States Senate, who has the responsibility for ratification of treaties signed by the United States and, as Article 6 of our Constitution states, Chuck, under the authority of the United States.
Well, let's break this down for a minute. It's a really bad treaty. But since it came out, it was originally introduced to the Senate for ratification in 1982. That means that President Ronald Reagan signed it.
Yes.
Am I arguing for it on that basis? No. This is one of those things that makes us go back and say Ronald Reagan has a reputation for being a conservative and just an all-around great constitutional thinker and all that. Well, this is one of those places where we can go to and say, not so fast, because the Law of the Sea Treaty is a complete surrender of United States autonomy on the seas. And in fact, yes, we do have autonomy on the seas. Now, what that doesn't mean, that doesn't mean that we get to go around attacking everyone's shipping, or that doesn't mean we get to sail into international waters and dump garbage, those kinds of things. That's not what our autonomy on the sea means. What it means is we get to continue to act as a sovereign nation on the high seas. Now, there has always been a quote-unquote law of the sea, and it has always been done by treaty. But in this case, what is happening is this treaty essentially turns ownership of the world's oceans over to the United Nations.
Absolutely, and it creates a new level of bureaucracy, Chuck, because part of what the treaty would put forward is a international claims adjudication body called the International Seabed Authority. Now, right. Chuck, I mean, come on, let's get realistic about this. What this is a way for the United Nations to favor their friends and punish their adversaries by reducing their ability to ship goods and personnel from point A to point B across open waters.
Well, that's exactly what it's about. It's also about, now I think about this, one of the real problems with this thing is the environmental, onerous environmental regulation that this would hand over to the United Nations. Now remember, the United Nations is the agency that sponsors the IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change. And the IPCC has been using propaganda, and it's now beginning to admit, because the whole global warming thing is unraveling, it's becoming clear that global warming is not caused by man. It's being caused by the natural causes like the sun and the amount of cosmic radiation that's being allowed to enter the atmosphere and those kinds of things. And for all these years, we've been being told by these people at the IPCC that we were causing all this, and therefore we needed this new regulatory power to tax things like carbon output. Now, one of the things that the Law of the Sea Treaty would do would be to turn sovereignty over offshore drilling over to the United Nations. and the International Seabed Authority. This is one of the major problems here. You've got places, especially in Europe, for instance, Great Britain, who is drilling in the North Sea. Well, that would be put under the authority of the United Nations under the Law of the Sea Treaty. Anything outside of a certain area automatically becomes jurisdiction of the United Nations. Now, is it difficult to imagine that a cabal could get together in the United Nations to force out Europe or force the United States out of the drilling offshore business? Not hard at all.
No, not at all.
If you put Arabs and, for instance, Arabs and Russians together, who are all sitting on these gigantic inland oil reserves, it would be very easy to see why certain countries, Venezuela, could very easily, and of course people who would be under the thumb of Venezuela because of their oil reserves, like Cuba and other nations. There are all kinds of point-to-points you could draw to see how the United States would suddenly find itself unable to drill offshore for the oil that it needs to run its industrial complex. This is why the Law of the Sea Treaty is awful. The United States needs to be able to operate on a friendly basis as an autonomous nation on the seas, not as a wholly owned subsidiary of the United Nations. And that's exactly what the Law of the Sea Treaty would do. It would make the United States subordinate on the seas, not the sovereign country able to go where it will go in the territories held by friendly nations to engage in the commerce that we need to be able to engage in to maintain our sovereignty and maintain our economy.
Well, certainly. And Chuck, I can also see this being used in such a way that you would have certain countries who would violate the treaty and use those sea lanes to attack others, such as the Somali pirates that we heard about so often a couple of years ago, but that if you were under the treaty, you wouldn't have any ability to retaliate. You wouldn't have any ability to defend yourself because the UN was already rattling sabers about that early on.
Yes, exactly. That's kind of my point. You know, American shipping was being attacked in their European shipping as well, but the Europeans can handle their own problems. European problems are not American problems. The United States of America needs to be able to protect its shipping. In the United States Constitution, Barry, there is a provision for the keeping up of a Navy.
Correct.
Now, it's in Article 1. Though the Army only exists in two-year increments, in other words, no appropriation can be made for an Army beyond 2 years. And that's why Army budgets are only 2 years long. It's a constitutional requirement. There is no such requirement for a Navy. And there's a reason for that, Barry. When the United States was founded, we were a commercial republic, which means that we needed to have access to the sea lanes in order to do the commerce that we needed to do to be able to survive and get our raw materials out around the world. Even before we had manufacturing here, we had to be able to get the raw materials to other people so they could make the goods that we could re-import back into the United States. And that's why the United States is allowed to maintain a permanent Navy, because that was designed to act as the protective arm of our shipping and commerce. And the fact is, you saw that in the what they call the Tripolitanian War during the Jefferson administration, when it, in fact, got a lot of controversy. But the fact is that we went in and finally wiped out the Tripolitanian pirates and showed them who was boss, and basically made them stop seizing American shipping and American sailors. They were actually seizing American sailors and ships and selling the sailors into slavery inside the Ottoman Empire. And those men never came back. They went into permanent slavery, usually becoming galley slaves or slaves on the farms of the rich and powerful in Turkey and the Ottoman Empire, and were never seen again. Well, we stopped that by the use of the Navy. That's exactly what the Navy is for. And the Somali pirates are certainly no better than the Tripolitanian pirates. And that we've sent the Navy out to handle those kinds of things. So when you understand it from that perspective, you understand why we can't turn that power over to someone who may strip us of our right to even have a Navy. We might be able to have a Navy, but it's locked up in mothballs in the San Diego shipyard.
Well, and Chuck, that's part of the reason I believe that, as I mentioned, this treaty was brought forward in 1982. to. And so 30 years later, we're still talking about it because every year this treaty is brought back before the United States Senate. And historically, the United States Senate has decided to pass on ratifying this treaty. And this year, it was looking a little difficult, but Senator Jim DeMint, who's a Republican senator from South Carolina, took the leadership on this, and he got enough of his colleagues, 34 to be exact total, so 33 of his other colleagues, to sign a letter to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid to basically say they would under no circumstances vote to ratify the treaty. And he was working on this for a little while, and he'd only gotten up to 30 signatures on this letter. But last week, he managed to get the other four signatures. And it's interesting because one of those four signatures, Chuck, is someone who's known to Ohio voters, and that is our junior U.S. Senator Rob Portman from Cincinnati. So Portman actually became the 34th signer on the letter that basically told Harry Reid, you don't have the votes to ratify the treaty.
Which means it won't come up for a vote.
Which means it won't come up for a vote. It's interesting because before everybody starts celebrating, remember, this has come up every year. So Senator DeMint, on his own website, stated clearly that the Law of the Sea Treaty is dead for this year. And I think he was very careful to say for this year because, again, Chuck, just like a bad penny, it always keeps turning up and turning up and turning up because there are many who want to have the United States lose all vestiges of their sovereignty and would like nothing better for us to hand over everything, including the ability to defend ourselves, to the United Nations and their international regulatory bodies.
Right. Let's talk for a minute why DeMint was able to get those extra four votes and the timing of it.
Yes.
Recently, there was a primary election in the state of Indiana.
Yes, there was.
And a longtime senator who was about 158 years old, I'm not sure he wasn't a Civil War veteran.
Richard Lugar
lost his right to run for re-election to that seat. And one of the big levers that people used to get him out was his open and vocal support for the Law of the Sea Treaty. Now, a common friend of ours posted on Facebook about Law of the Sea Treaty and talked about, you know, congratulate Rob Portman and thank him for signing on. And I basically said, okay, what took him so long? What took him so long? This thing's been around since Reagan, and it was just as bad then as it is now. As we know, it's been reworked supposedly to quell the concerns of those of us who had questions about United States sovereignty by giving the United States a permanent seat on the ISA, the International Seabed Authority. And I'm like, so what? How does that affect American sovereignty? That gives the United States one vote on a committee.
Yeah, well, supposedly it gave a permanent veto as well on the decisions, but we've seen how well that's worked on the UN Security Council.
Exactly, Barry, exactly. It has meant nothing. Yeah, we've used it a few times. But nonetheless, we still take it on the chin in the UN all the time. And this, all the Security Council does is basically decide where and when to send troops. And lately, we've been leading the charge on sending the UN here, there, and another place. So much for our veto power. And nobody else is using theirs against us. So, but that being said, don't kid yourself that there weren't a bunch of sitting senators who realized that in short order, they're coming up sometime within the next 2 years or so, who didn't look at it, Republicans especially, and say, you know, I better sign on to this thing. Rob Portman being one of them.
Yes.
Now, you can guarantee, and this is another reason that I'm not going to come out partisanship, but Sherrod Brown needs to go because he is a vocal supporter of this thing, from what I understand.
Yes, he is definitely not a signatory on the letter, and he has been a vocal supporter of the U.S. entering into the Law of the Sea Treaty. And thus Sherrod Brown would like us to have our sovereignty be lost.
Well, that's no shock. I don't know where his opponent stands, however. So, on this issue, don't know.
Don't know, so if you're out there, and since this is an election year, you have Sherrod Brown and Ohio Treasurer Josh Mandel, who are running against each other. So it'd be a good idea, ladies and gentlemen, to ask each of them directly where they stand on the ratification of the Law of the Sea Treaty.
That's right. Now, we are, of course, out of time, as we always are. So all I can say is join us again tomorrow for another Principles and Policies.